From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are now 7 days into a partial government shutdown over border wall funding. This morning on Twitter, President Trump once again threatened to shut down the southern border if he doesn't get the $5 billion he wants to build a wall.
But Democrats who take control in the House next week aren't budging. And the president's acting chief of staff said today the president will stay in Washington over the New Year's holiday instead of going to Florida. Let's convene our Friday politics roundtable. Thank goodness they are in town. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
And Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for NPR. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
Let's start with the shutdown. On CBS this morning, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked if the president would accept less money than he wants, that $5 billion, maybe $2 billion, in wall funding, just to end this shutdown. Let's listen.
Look, we've made that clear to the Democrats. I'm not going to negotiate in the press, but the president has been willing to negotiate on this point, and the Democrats have not been willing to do anything.
Well, look, there was a bipartisan short-term spending measure passed by the Senate. It was thought the president would sign it. And then he was berated by conservative radio hosts, changed his tune. Last year, there was a bipartisan immigration measure, including construction of the president's proposed wall, just over a 10-year period, not immediately. He's had opportunities. Beth, start with you. What's your sense about whether he and maybe even the Republicans really want to get the wall and lose this rallying point?
Well, I think he wants the wall because that was certainly the central promise of his campaign in 2016 was to build that wall along the Mexican border. But of course, at the time, the rallying cry was, and Mexico will pay for it. Now that we know that that's not going to happen, Trump has had to recalibrate a little bit, but he's definitely sticking with his central campaign promise of that wall. Now, the problem is that the timing is all wrong. He should have accepted the deal that was discussed earlier this year, as you mentioned, Robin. It was a great deal compared to what they're discussing now. It would have been money for the wall, much more money than they're talking about now, mm-hmm. in exchange for codifying DACA. The president
This is the path to citizenship
mm-hmm. for those young mm-hmm. dreamers who came to the country brought here illegally by their parents. That deal was taken off the table. President Trump rejected it. And since that deal was put aside, Democrats won the House. Mm-hmm. So the negotiating posture for both sides is very different now. And Democrats really don't have much reason to compromise with President Trump mm-hmm. here. So he's lost a lot of his leverage in the months that passed since that original deal was discussed.
Well, Kelsey, give us a sense of what the strategy is from the Democrats' point of view. They seem to be taking a low-profile approach this week.
Well, part of that is because they are about to take control of the House. As we've mentioned, they've got just about a week left before they start swearing in Democrats. And their feeling is that they can come in and immediately pass a spending bill, likely one that looks very much like what already passed in the Senate. And then it will be up to the president and the ball will be in his court. They're looking at a situation where they think they can't lose here. I've talked to many Democrats who say that they want the president to have the burden and the onus of saying, I'm refusing to sign this. I'm refusing to reopen the government. And while Republicans think that that'll be a bad look for them to start their first couple of days of control of the House with a fight about a shutdown, the border wall is a major political issue for them, and it is a major core issue for them. We've heard House Minority Leader, soon likely to be Speaker Nancy Pelosi, refer to the immigration policies of President Trump as immoral. Mm-hmm. When you start talking about policy in those terms, it changes the calculus completely, away from being something where you are having a policy debate and something when you're something where you're talking about core beliefs.
Well, but Beth, most people, you're talking about, you know, how this is hitting the electorate and the base, but don't polls show that most people are blaming President Trump for the shutdown and they don't want the wall?
Right. Most people are. The polling is showing that very clearly, that more Americans blame the president than congressional Democrats for the shutdown. And let's also remember, Robin, immigration was a core issue that Trump tried to hit very hard in the days leading up to the midterms. He really refocused the whole discussion around immigration and people coming through the border and the caravan and bringing disease and drugs and all of that, shifted away from what Republican leaders in Congress had hoped he'd be talking about, which was the economy. And that calculation did not work for President Trump. Voters overwhelmingly rejected that language about the border and immigration and such, and especially in those suburban areas that used to be very receptive to Republican candidates. They voted for Democrats. So his calculation didn't work then, and it's surprising that he would think it would work better now.
Trump took his first trip to visit troops in a combat zone this week, and he was criticized for politicizing that trip. In a speech to troops, he said the U.S. shouldn't be doing the fighting for every nation on Earth without being reimbursed. Let's listen.
So we're not the suckers of the world. We're no longer the suckers, folks. And people aren't looking at us as suckers.
And on All Things Considered yesterday, General John Allen, who once led U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, was asked if he was offended by that comment. Here's what he said.
I am, because somehow in those comments, he diminishes the sacrifices of our troops.
Kelsey, what struck you about the president's visit and the criticism he's been receiving since?
Well, the thing that I think is very, very striking about the criticism in particular is that it seems to be quite bipartisan. And it is part of a long series now, a growing series of times when Republicans have been dismayed about the way this president handles himself on the foreign stage and in the global realm. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of concerns that he is looking at right now, filling a number of jobs related to national security and homeland that they're wondering what kind of people the president is going to pick and whether or not the president will now have an opportunity to make a major shakeup to the way that American foreign policy is handled. It is not what Republicans thought that they were going to get, despite the fact that Trump was pretty clear during the campaign about his feelings about America needing to be more of an isolationist country. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of angst happening in both among Republicans and Democrats. And I wouldn't be totally surprised if this becomes a major issue as they go into confirmations to fill positions like, you know, the Attorney General or the Secretary of Defense.
I want to ask you about that, Beth. But before, just a comment about hearing the president standing in front of troops and saying that previous to this time, which would presumably be, you know, the last 10 years of the war in Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, American troops there were suckers. You know, you ask a Vietnam War veteran, there's nothing worse than thinking you were a sucker. So a lot of response to that. But who does step into that role of Secretary of Defense, working alongside somebody who has said these kinds of things to troops? The president said Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan could be there for a long time, that he's in no rush to fill that position after the forced resignation, the early resignation of Jim Mattis. So, you know, Beth, your thoughts about not having a defense secretary or someone to talk to him, apparently, about how to talk to the military?
Well, and not just the military, but as Kelsey was saying, his kind of whole overseas posture has been criticized recently. And that comes in part because he's just relying on very little expertise. I mean, not only does he not have a permanent Secretary of Defense right now, the State Department's very thinly staffed, the diplomatic corps very thinly staffed. We've seen this president sort of preside over a shrinkage of the U.S. government, which, you know, perhaps sounds good in theory to some conservatives who think that the federal government is too big. But you need people. You need people in these positions, particularly when dealing with delicate foreign policy matters. You just don't. The president ought not to be blundering into things overseas without speaking to people who have experience in those regions and in talking to members of the military, talking to leaders of other countries, and understanding that there is a protocol in the way that people are expected to behave. Now, of course, President Trump has fashioned himself as a disruptor. That's a lot of why he was elected. But whether this is an appropriate realm for him to be doing that kind of disruption is mm-hmm. really up for question.
This was a week in which we saw the worst Christmas day for stocks ever and the biggest point gain for the Dow ever. And it continues. The volatility continues. Kelsey, how worried is the White House about this? I'm just reading a CNBC story posted today that says that a Trump administration official asked an investor for advice on the markets amid the wild ride for stocks, and that one of the pieces of advice that he got was tell Trump to stop criticizing the Fed chair.
Well, that point about not criticizing the Fed chair seems to be a serious and ongoing theme among economists and lawmakers and pretty much anybody watching this from a professional standpoint. However, I think that there is a thing that's happening here that we see happen all the time where people are taking the opportunity to choose which things that they are going to give the president credit for. So you see the White House giving the president credit for the times when the market is on the upswing mm-hmm. and backing away from the times when things are on the downswing. Now, that is not not uncommon for presidents in general. That is something that just happens in politics. But
he takes more credit in the good times than I've seen a president take in the past.
Because there is the peril of then being in ownership of the downside.
Yeah. Look, we only have about a minute left. And in that, we're going to ask each of you, your reporters, you like to live in the moment and in real time. But we want each of you to give us a prediction for the next year. Beth?
Yeah, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the 2020 presidential race, which is going to start in earnest probably in the next month or so. Right now, we've got about 30 Democrats looking to jump in, which is pretty extraordinary.
I think Jeremy's looking to jump in.
Yeah, right.
I think Jeremy should. It might also get cut down to about 15, which is still a very large number, particularly when you're talking about campaigning in those small early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, how they're going to absorb 15 pretty credible potential Democratic presidential candidates is going to be quite something to see.
We're going to have to give Kelsey the next 30. Go ahead, Kelsey.
I will just say, I'll keep it quick, that I imagine that politics will remain unpredictable. And so my prediction is just unpredictable politics.
Wow. You're going out on a limb there, Kelsey.
Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for NPR, and Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. Happy New Year to both of you. Thank you.
Happy New Year
to you.
As 2018 draws to a close, the plaudits keep coming for author Rebecca Mackay. Her novel, The Great Believers, was one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year, one of the Washington Post's 50 notable books, and a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction, though it's very much based in fact. It's set in 1985 Chicago. The AIDS crisis is rocking the gay community, which is caring for the dying, mourning the dead, trying to decide whether to take a test that just came out for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and figuring out who to trust. The disease was almost always fatal and was primarily transmitted sexually. The novel also braids in a modern-day storyline. Fiona, whose brother died in 1985, is confronting the effect that's had on her for decades. So, Rebecca Mackay would have been 7 in the mid-80s. How does she get this all so pitch-perfect? How did she know a big concern at the time was pets left behind by the fallen, or that a Chicago hospital ward turned into a loving community? Well, for one thing, she wrote parts of the book in what used to be that ward, feeling the ghosts around her. She also finds footage of the AIDS group ACT UP protesting, read about the work of local ACT UP leader Danny Sotomayor. And as we found out when we spoke with Rebecca Mackay last June, setting the novel in Chicago became an imperative.
I'm from Chicago, and before I even knew the direction the book was really going to take, I wanted to write a Chicago novel. But as I started my research, I was kind of horrified by how little there was out there about the AIDS crisis in Chicago in specific. Even looking at some of the big, noteworthy nonfiction books about AIDS, Chicago's not even in the index. Mm. And this is the third biggest city in America.
Well, and you started talking to people and finding out what impact the disease had. And I just love it that for you, a lot of this was revelation. How did you do this? You get the young men who died with no will. Sometimes their families wouldn't let their friends even come to funerals. People are petrified of their blood. How'd you get all of this?
Part of my research was primary sources because there weren't books out there. I was going into the library and looking at back issues of gay weeklies from the 80s. But the other side of it was that I was seeking out people. And everyone I talked to, I asked them at the end, who should I talk to next? Mm. Until I was talking to doctors, nurses, survivors, of course, journalists, historians, lawyers, activists, and eventually found, you know, people who'd been diagnosed with AIDS or with HIV, rather, quite early on and were still with us. Mm. Often people who did not expect to be with us. So their perspective on things was really interesting to me.
Sure, because the cocktail came out that could very much prolong life. But, you know, your book is set before that.
Exactly.
You also, we understand, found a 1990 Chicago Reader article about the big ACT UP protest, it was in front of the Cook County building. You have your characters participating in this protest. People can go to YouTube and they can see some of it. People laying down on the ground, getting harshly arrested by police. How were you informed by that?
I became certain that this scene, this protest, was going to be in some ways a culmination for my characters, especially for Yale, my main character, who's a very timid person. I needed to get him to the point where he would join this protest and be out there in the street. At the same time, I'm rewriting history in many ways because although I wanted to write very much about real events, I didn't want to write about real people. For one thing, I reinvented the gay press scene in Chicago. I made different newspapers because I needed to have an editor. I couldn't have it be that actual person. I also reinvented the ACT UP leaders, and I put some other people in there. But there is a point where my characters look up, and five men have come out onto the ledge outside a window of the county building right in downtown Chicago and take off their Oxford shirts to reveal ACT UP t-shirts, and they unfurl this banner that says, "We demand equal health care now." Mm. And then one by one, they're violently dragged back into the building. Yeah. This was something I was watching on YouTube. It's something that I heard about from a lot of people firsthand. And towards the end of my research, I actually got to meet one of the surviving men who was out there on the ledge, this activist named Bill McMillan, who was diagnosed very early and is still with us. And I felt like I was meeting people who'd stepped out of the Revolutionary War. You know, I felt like I'd been reading about these people, studying them as heroes, as war heroes in my mind. Mm. And one of them sitting across from me now in a restaurant, showing me his scrapbook.
You mentioned war. There's another storyline here. Yale, one of your characters, works for a Chicago museum. He acquires paintings, and he's working on a donation from an elderly woman. She's personally picked him. And we slowly realize why. It's because this was art that she collected of many of the men she loved, artists who were killed either by World War I or the 1918 flu epidemic, which killed between 20 and 40 million people. And the parallel is so obvious.
Yeah, that was really where I started the book, was with the parallels between those two generations, these decimated generations. In America, we think a lot about the writers, the lost generation who went there after the war. But before World War I, you have visual artists coming there from all over Europe, Soutine, Modigliani, Fujita. They've all arrived in Paris as this refuge where they're going to learn art. And then the war comes and interrupts everything. Mm-hmm. And the parallels between that and the way that so many people had gotten to Chicago, they'd gotten to this place where they could be happy, where they could form a chosen family. And then this other kind of war comes through and destroys so much of what they had.
Your characters have flaws. Come to find out they're human. Some of them make terrible, terrible mistakes in whether or not they want to take the test or telling themselves they're going to abstain from sexual relations and then they don't. And, you know, it's a disease in which one mistake can be a fatal mistake. But the way they wrestle over this, there's one paragraph that I think gets at the heart of it. Can you read us, Teddy's one of the characters who hasn't wanted to take the test, which again just came out in 1985. Given how they're viewed by society, you've got conservatives like Jesse Helms. There are people openly saying they should all die. So please, could you set that up and then read that paragraph for us?
Yes, absolutely. So Yale, my main character, has found his friend Teddy, and they're, it's immediately after the Pride Parade in 1987, and they've gone over to the park and they're in line for some food. And Teddy is a philosophy graduate student, so he tends to spout off a little bit. And this is him spouting off. "The thing is," Teddy said, "the disease itself feels like a judgment. We've all got a little Jesse Helms on our shoulder, right? If you got it from sleeping with 1,000 guys, then it's a judgment on your promiscuity. If you got it from sleeping with one guy once, that's almost worse. It's like a judgment on all of us. Like the act itself is the problem and not the number of times you did it. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, it's a judgment on your hubris. And if you got it because you knew you could and you didn't care, it's a judgment on how much you hate yourself."
What are you hearing now? You have the joke in there. If you have to tell your parents, you know, you have the virus, the trick is how do you convince them you're Haitian?
Right.
And not gay. Because there was an outbreak in Haiti, too. What are people today telling you about how that aspect of this felt?
You know, I found myself in many cases sort of playing psychiatrist to the people I was talking to. I was often asking them questions like, why do you think you're still here? And no one's answer was ever medical. Everyone's answer had something to do with God, luck, family, you know, psychology, something like that. No one ever said, well, I've always had a really strong immune system. And I think it's the kind of brutal randomness that makes you think in terms of fate and in terms of guilt and the survivor's guilt that anyone still alive with HIV is burdened with. You know, I was hearing stories of people who, before the test, were certain that they had it and never even had it. Mm-hmm. Then the people who had the virus and made their wills, said goodbye to everyone, got ready, and they're still here. Then the people who didn't make it, who I couldn't interview, you know, what might have gone through their mind. And at a time when so many people in the world were so eager to jump in and tell them it was their fault. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about very vulnerable people in so many cases who are primed, maybe unfortunately, to believe that.
Well, but you're talking now about carrying someone else's story into this, you know, fiction book. And you said at one point, this project was undertaken with a great deal of ongoing thought and conversation and concern about the line between allyship and appropriation.
Yeah. You know, I'm a straight woman, and I'm writing about things I wasn't there for. But I felt like to do this, I needed to answer two questions for myself. And the first was, can I do this well? That's not for me to answer, but I felt like my answer to myself was, I think I can do it well if I research enough. And the second question was, is this stealing a voice from anyone in this community who would want to publish this kind of narrative, or do I have the opportunity with this to amplify those voices? And ultimately, my answer to that, the way publishing works, the more successful my book is, the more likely a publisher is to throw money behind a similar book in the future. And as I go around and talk about my book, I have the chance to recommend other narratives, first-person accounts, nonfiction books, as well as talking about the actual history of what happened. So there might be people who feel like they would not want a narrative coming from someone who wasn't there. But for people who are interested in a fictional account, I've done my best.
Rebecca Mackay, the book is The Great Believers, a novel. It's just terrific. We'll have an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Mackay speaking with us about her novel, The Great Believers, back in June.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
There are developments in northeastern Syria in what's been a very hot spot near the Turkish border. In the days after President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria, the Kurdish forces allied with the U.S. there have been under threat of attack from Turkey, which considers them terrorists because they're linked to Kurds who stage attacks in Turkey. Now, though, it looks like the Kurds have agreed to give up some ground and allow the Syrian military to come take control, something that could diffuse the Turkish threats. Joining us now, NPR's Ruth Sherlock. She's in northeastern Syria. Ruth, tell us about this deal that seems to be in the works between the Kurds and the Syrian government.
Hi, yes. Well, it all focuses on the town of Manbij, which is an area on the edge of the Kurdish heartlands here in Syria. And this place has been a center point of Turkish opposition to the Kurdish influence in Syria, so much so that the U.S. had to strike a deal where U.S. troops started doing these joint patrols with Turkey, all to try to diffuse the tensions there. But the announcements of the U.S. potential withdrawal means that Turkey has upped its rhetoric again and said that it's going to stage an attack on the area and move troops here. Now the Syrian regime, though, has come into play. Just today, a Syrian military commander appeared in a video statement.
The
So it's a rhetoric-filled speech, and he says the Syrian army is going to protect every inch of its sovereign nation. And he claims that Syrian forces have moved inside Manbij and raised the Syrian flag there. But Kurdish officials and sources we've spoken to in Manbij say there's no sign of the military inside the town just yet. And US troops are still in Manbij. And the US military has said in a statement that the reports of this Syrian army advance are incorrect. What we're hearing is that the regime troops may have stationed themselves on the outskirts of the town, where they've been in recent days, and that the talks are ongoing.
This all feeds into the question of what happens to the Kurdish areas across the region once the U.S. withdraws.
That is the question that Kurdish officials are scrambling to answer here. During the fight against ISIS, when they were the militia that fought on the side of the US, they took a huge sweep of territory, and it's a really important part of Syria too. There's oil here, and there's important agricultural plains. So the US withdrawal now leaves them vulnerable to an attack. So the talks over Manbij with the Syrian regime are more out of necessity. They've been historically marginalized by Syria, and they say they won't give up this terrain to the government without trying to manage some kind of a deal where they get better rights for their people.
Ruth, you're joining us from Syria. It's actually very rare for us to talk to somebody who's inside Syria. What is it like there where you are at the moment?
Well, people in this area, in this Kurdish-held part of Syria, are very nervous about what we've, you know, about the news that we've just been talking about. There are anti-Turkish protests taking place here. In general, there's a lot of anger and frustration at the Trump administration's decision to withdraw U.S. troops. They see this as a huge betrayal. We've spoken to people who lost as many as 7 members of their families fighting ISIS, partly on behalf of the U.S. And now this sudden withdrawal, they say, leaves them abandoned. Syrians across this region, both Arab and Kurd, say a sudden withdrawal here would leave us exposed and in danger to so many uncertainties, and this is really the last thing we need after so many years of war in this country.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock speaking with us from northeastern Syria. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you.
The iconic retailer Sears may be on its last legs today. Its chairman, Eddie Lampert, has until 4 p.m. East Coast time today to submit an offer to save the company from liquidation. He's offered $4.6 billion via his hedge fund to keep the company together, but so far has not been able to secure financing for the deal, pushing Sears' fate down to the wire. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, we recall that Sears filed for bankruptcy in October. Walk us through what's at stake today.
Well, of course, you know, Jeremy, that many companies still operate in bankruptcy as a not a going concern. But today, you might just see the end of Sears, period, full stop. I mean, this company has had so many second leases on life from Lampert himself. He originally made his bet in 2005 and 2006. And at this point, the markets are saying, why throw more good money after bad?
And that's what he wants to do, though. I mean, he probably wouldn't put it that way, but that's what he wants to do, is put more money into this company and try to save it.
Well, maybe stave off a liquidation, maybe make it more of a slow-mo liquidation so he doesn't lose everything at once. After all, he has invested billions into this. And if it were just to disappear overnight, you'd flood the market with property, with workers, with fire sales. And it's something that nobody wants to see, from their creditors to their employees to the real estate market broadly.
There are 68,000 employees currently depending on Lampert today. If Sears does liquidate, what happens to all those people?
You have all of these retail employees that are dealing with a soft retail environment. After all, I mean, it's not easy for Target and for Walmart. You saw what happened at Toys R Us, and a retail environment that is ill-equipped to absorb such an inundation of workers. But certainly this has been a long time coming.
And then you look at the fact that top Sears executives received $25 million in bonuses this year, even as Sears began closing hundreds of stores. Why does that happen?
It just blows the mind how in a liquidation you have people who have preferential treatment when equity holders are being wiped out. You wonder why management still has anything in this, especially if about 70,000 workers are going to lose their job.
So just hours to go and just seconds to go in our segment here, Robin, what are you expecting?
I think that whether or not it happens today, whether maybe a judge or Lampert gets an extra week extension or something to line up funding, that Sears is certainly headed toward extinction, like so many dozens of retailers behind it.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, have you ever heard of a guy named Lloyd Gaines? In December 1938, 80 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in his favor in a case against the University of Missouri School of Law. The court said the school violated the Constitution when it rejected his application because he was black. Experts say his civil rights case could have done what Brown v. the Board of Education did, and it would have been done 15 years earlier. But Gaines disappeared, and that killed the case. As Catherine Palmer of member station KBIA reports, 80 years later, the University of Missouri is still struggling with that history.
At the University of Missouri, students are bustling in and out of classes. It's the state's flagship institution of higher learning in Columbia. In the 1930s, it was home to Missouri's only public law school, and the whole university was segregated. If a black student wanted to pursue a law degree, the state paid for them to go out of state. The NAACP was on the lookout for a plaintiff who could challenge the law at the federal level. At Lincoln University, one of two historically black universities in Missouri, history professor and civil rights activist Lorenzo J. Green was surveying the young minds in his class for the perfect candidate. Here's his son, Lorenzo.
What he sought to do was to find students brilliant enough to break down this barrier that stood before them.
Enter Lloyd Gaines. When he met Professor Green in the early 1930s as an undergrad, Gaines was at the top of his class.
They were discussing the University of Missouri, and he asked, did they think that it was fair that the university would not accept people of color? And they all said no. And so they said, well, you know, what could you do?
So, in 1935, the same year he graduated from Lincoln, Gaines applied to the MU School of Law, which promptly rejected his application because of his race. The NAACP had its case. Gaines sued the university registrar, Silas W. Canada, first in circuit court, denied. He appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court, denied. Litigation went on for years, and Gaines earned a master's degree in economics from the University of Michigan while he waited for his case to move through the courts.
He was the blunt instrument that was going to deal the death blow to the law.
The day finally came. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down its opinion in December 1938, ruling the rejection of Gaines's application on the basis of his race a violation of his 14th Amendment right to equal protection. Suddenly, at age 27, Lloyd Gaines was front page news.
He became this instant personality.
Dwayne Smith has spent hundreds of hours researching the Gaines case.
No one had ever did something like that before. You know, keep in mind, this is decades before Rosa Parks, decades before Martin Luther King.
Smith is the provost and vice president of academic affairs at Harris Stowe State University in St. Louis. Back in the 1930s, it was known as Stowe Teachers College, which Gaines attended briefly before transferring to Lincoln and Jefferson City. The Supreme Court said the University of Missouri must either admit Gaines or provide an in-state law school of equal caliber for black students. Missouri quickly got to work on the second option and opened Lincoln University Law School in St. Louis in an old beauty shop. Smith says its resources were far from equal to MU's.
There was a sense of pride that there was a black law school, but it was kind of mired in controversy because the understanding was that it was established to keep African Americans, and namely Lloyd Gaines, out of Missouri Law School.
Gaines didn't plan on attending. Instead, the NAACP prepared to sue again, this time to get Gaines into the MU School of Law and dismantle segregated education once and for all. But Gaines was getting tired of the spotlight. In the winter of 1939, Lloyd Gaines moved to Chicago to stay with a few fraternity brothers, look for a job, clear his head. Then one night, he said he was going out for stamps. No one ever saw him again. Few people took notice, though, until months later, when his lawyers couldn't find him to prepare for the next court hearing. With no plaintiff, the NAACP dropped the case. 15 years after Gaines disappeared, the segregation wall Gaines had almost torn down finally crumbled. In 1954, the Supreme Court issued its opinion on Brown v. Board of Education and ruled segregated schools unconstitutional. But integrating formerly all-white institutions like MU wasn't easy, says one of its first black law students, Michael Middleton.
I've always considered myself a part of the movement.
Middleton went on to work as a civil rights attorney and law professor. He served as interim president at the University of Missouri's four-campus system between 2015 and 2017, in the immediate aftermath of student-led anti-racism protests at the Columbia campus.
So the Lloyd Gaines story was motivational for me.
In 1969, Middleton joined other students in protesting the isolation of black students on campus, calling for, among other things, acknowledgement of MU's racist history.
People get comfortable and complacent and don't understand the importance of dealing honestly with it until it explodes on them.
It exploded in Columbia 3 years ago during the fall of 2015.
This is not an indictment on white folks, but it is an indictment on white structures and white supremacy.
The protests were fueled by repeated instances of racial slurs directed at black students, met with limited responses from the university administration. Protesters focused on the university's long arc of racism, including Lloyd Gaines' story.
In 1935, Lloyd Gaines applied to the MU Law School!
In the 3 years since the protests, MU has installed new leadership and publicized its commitment to diversity and inclusion. On the ground, though, MU is still struggling to recruit and retain black students and faculty. Although Gaines's legacy is still in the making, any leads on his whereabouts after March 19, 1939 are frozen solid. And while there's still no answers 80 years later, for many across the country, the case of Lloyd Gaines is too important to forget. For Here and Now, I'm Catherine Palmer.
And now we have a cautionary note. A recall of You by Kotex Sleek tampons made between October 2016 and October 2018, which also gives us an opportunity to talk about tampons, a conversation that may not be for everyone, but a lot of women will be all ears. Tampons have an interesting history. The early Egyptians used a form for contraception. The modern cardboard applicator was patented by a man in 1931, but Gertrude Tendrich bought it and made the tampons out of cloth on her sewing machine. There was skepticism. Would they give young women erotic feelings, maybe deflower them? But then during World War II, tampons took off when women took the place of men in factories. And now we have this recall. It came after reports that some of the You by Kotex Sleek tampons came apart on removal. Some women had to get medical help in getting pieces out. Others reported infections. Dr. Jessica Shepherd is an OBGYN at Baylor University Medical Center. Dr. Shepherd, you want to point out that while there may be additives in tampons, women should check. You don't think this recall is cause for alarm, that by and large tampons are safe?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a recall like this is not necessarily something that would say not to use tampons. It's just something to make sure that they are safe in every aspect.
Right. And for women to know, if you've been having a little problem, go to your doctor because pieces left inside cannot be a good thing.
Absolutely. As soon as this was heard by Kimberly-Clark, they pulled their product. This is a point of where we can educate on how to use tampons correctly, making sure that they're being used at the appropriate time as well.
And just remind us, there was once the toxic shock syndrome scare, TSS. Remind us what that was, and is it still an issue? And are there women who just can't use tampons?
There are some women who should not or can't use tampons, women who might have a medical condition, or sometimes they have some anomalies or abnormalities within the reproductive system that would not allow them to use tampons. But outside of that, tampons really can be used by anybody. Now, when you go back to toxic shock syndrome, that really goes down to the education of how to use the product. Because when you think of toxic shock syndrome, it really has to do with an infection in your body that what we call a superbacteria is released after having a tampon in for extended amount of time, extended duration, that allows that bacteria to then go into your bloodstream, causing what we call TSS or toxic shock syndrome. And so these women will present with some type of symptoms, anywhere from a very high fever to sometimes a rash and sometimes some pelvic tenderness that really needs to be paid attention to, because it really can precipitate more of a shock, which can have their whole body shut down. So the fact that that could happen is, you know, very shocking, mm-hmm. but it is also very rare. And so what we found when that happened back in the 70s and the 80s is that there needed to be more education, one, about the product and how it's used, and also for women to understand with tampon use, it really does depend on what type of tampon you're using for the certain part of your cycle as far as absorbency, but also the duration of time that you're using the tampon and not exceeding that time.
Well, and while we have you, we just want to ask a quick question, because in looking into this, it's fascinating. I mean, there was a museum of menstruation until recently. It had 3,000 objects in it. There is a Society for Menstrual Cycle Research. This is a rich topic. There's now a movement called Menstrual Equality, promoting the idea that people should have free access to products, but also, as you say, know what's in them. So your thoughts on companies now, Lola, Cora, making tampons from organic cotton, maybe with no plastic applicators. Thinks is another company. THINX makes underwear with built-in menstruation protection. There's the Diva Cup. It's an insert starting to become popular. Your thoughts, should women be thinking a little more beyond just grabbing the box off the shelf?
You know, I think that as we progress and pay more attention to women and menstruation, more products that are available to women, that they have more choices, more options, is absolutely brilliant. Products such as the Diva Cup or Thinks, that to me is a way of being more forward thinking about what we can actually use during menstruation and not limited to only certain types of products. That is a way for women to express themselves and how they are individually.
Well, it's really quite something. This has started a conversation among women of a certain age in our workforce, remembering, oh, bulky pads and safety pins, or a sort of like garter yeah. belt. You know, even though this is maybe a little upsetting for women to hear that there is a recall, there have been so many advances.
Oh, absolutely. When you were talking about the Museum of Menstruation, if you can imagine going back to times in history when there weren't any products like this to be used, and women have seen progress in sanitary napkins and tampons, I really do believe that when there is a recall, it doesn't necessarily mean that the product is bad. It means that there needs to be some changes in how it was made, but not necessarily that it can't be used at all.
By the way, one of the items in the museum is Fresca powder. It is a powder that was marketed for menstruation, the relief of the symptoms. It was also used to treat insect bites and burning feet. It's good we've moved on from that. Dr. Jessica Shepherd, again, OBGYN at Baylor University Medical Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
Now you know. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.